All right, so like I said, we have only two more studies left in this. We're going to wrap up on wrath tonight. And then next time I teach, which is like 3 weeks from now, we're going to talk about God's judgment of sin. So what's God done about sin, and what should we do as a response? Last week we began the study of wrath, and it's been a part of our ongoing study in the topic of sin. And the last three sins we've been looking at are what we call emotional sins, right? So the Bible talks a lot about our emotions, and it says that having emotions are not a bad thing, but when you listen to and obey your emotions, then you start falling into sin. The three emotions that we've taken a look at have been cynicism, which is related to sorrow and depression. We also took a look at anxiety, which is related to fear. And then last week, like I said, we started wrath. If you've missed them, they're on the site. You can give them a listen, and that'll hopefully help you understand these a little bit better. But a little bit of a recap on wrath and what we talked about last week for those of you guys who weren't here. Wrath is, like I said, is related to anger, and anger is a good thing. Anger is something that God has given us. It's something that He Himself has. God has anger. He gets angry. Anger is the emotional response that we are supposed to have towards injustice. So when things are unjust, when they're not right, then you should respond with anger. Jesus multiple times got angry in His earthly ministry. He got angry when He went into the temple and He saw that people were taking advantage of those who didn't know God, and He flipped tables and He actually made a whip, and it was pretty hardcore, right? Jesus got angry at the funeral of Lazarus. It says that when He saw the decay and death that had touched His once perfect creation, He actually got so angry He started to snort like a horse. He got really PO'd, you know? So Jesus experienced the emotion of anger. It's not a bad thing. In fact, there are multiple passages in the Bible. One that we read last week is Psalm 4, verse 4, where it says, "Be angry and do not sin," meaning that we're actually commanded to be angry in a lot of instances. In fact, if you are not angry in certain instances of your life, you're actually sinning. So if we as Christians look out and we see massive injustices happening in the world and we're not impacted by it emotionally at all, the Bible would say that's wrong, right? If you one day are a parent and you see that your child is being picked on or abused and you do not respond emotionally to that, you're like, crap happens, you know, so what? It'll toughen the kid up. You know, that's bad. The Bible would say that's a negative thing. That's not a good thing. You ought to feel angry at that, right? So anger can be a good thing. But when it goes bad, that's what we're talking about. That's what we would call wrath, right? And it could go bad in several ways. I'm just going to run down with them real quick. The first way it could go bad is when our anger is tied to our pride. So like I said, anger is the emotional response to injustice. But when we become very proud and arrogant, instead of being angry about actual injustices, you're going to be angry about what you view as unfair, which might not actually be an injustice. I used last week the example of when you're driving in traffic, right? Why do you get frustrated at traffic? You get frustrated because you have a way that you think that traffic should operate, and it's not functioning that way, right? The world isn't responding to your needs, and so you get angry. You get angry at the people in front of you. You get angry at the weather. You get angry at the stoplights. This anger is coming from your view of how the world ought to be. And when it's not that way, you get upset. You get frustrated. You get angry. This also leads to a lot of impulsiveness. The more proud you become, the more arrogant you become, the more impulsive in your anger you become. So people, when we call it, they have short fuses. The reason why they have short fuses is because they're so proud, they're so arrogant, that whenever they have the slightest emotion of anger, they use it, and they use it as an excuse to blow up on people. They use it as an excuse to beat up people to make themselves feel better about who they are, right? They just see injustices everywhere. They see the world as being unfair because they don't like the way that their life is going, and so they're going to blame people. The next way that anger can go bad is with bitterness. We talked last week that the Bible describes bitterness as a root. It's something that's rooted in you. It's beneath the surface. It's bubbling up within you, and it expresses itself at certain points. And bitterness can be formed in many different ways. We talked about some of the ways last week. I'm not going to get into them tonight. But essentially, bitterness is that implosive type of anger. It's the anger that you refuse to acknowledge and you refuse to express, so it just simmers below the surface. and it causes you to, in your mind, hate people around you without ever outwardly expressing it, until finally it comes out in a violent way. Explosive wrath usually results from bitterness. It comes out of bitterness. Explosive wrath is how we express our wrath towards other people. And there's many ways that you can be explosive. A lot of times when we hear the word explosive wrath or an explosive person, we think about the person who's just yelling at people all the time and screaming at them and trying to get their way. But that's not always true. Sometimes you could express your wrath in many different ways. You could express your wrath by antagonizing somebody. You like antagonizing them because you like getting a response from them. That makes you feel better, right? That's explosive wrath. Sometimes you could express explosive wrath by even, this is twisted, but you could actually forgive someone, and that's a form of wrath. Because when you forgive them, you're not forgiving them because you've actually forgiven them. You've forgiven them to make them feel really bad about what they did to you, right? So you're like, yeah, you did that to me, but I'm the better person because I'm forgiving you, brother, you know, just to stick it to them a little bit harder, right? Or you can express explosive wrath through rebelliousness, right? You just, you don't listen to someone, or you don't obey them, or you don't follow them simply because you hate them, right? You have that explosive wrath, and that's the way you're expressing it, is by not being submissive to them, by rebelling against them, whether it's the law or whatever. And a lot of our rebelliousness, by the way, comes from explosive wrath. One more way that I'll give you before we move on is you could express explosive wrath through what we call like non-forgiveness. So refusing to forgive someone and letting them know that they always reminding them of their failure in the past. Trying to stick it to them, trying to make them feel bad all the time, bringing up their past failures to bring them down, right? Even showing them disrespect. And hoping once again that they feel small as a result of our tone, right? This is all versions of explosive wrath. There's many more, but I just wanted to give you guys a couple to think about. Those are the forms of explosive wrath that we talked about. The solution we touched on briefly last week. Tonight we're going to go really deep into it. The solution is that God needs to, first of all, work on our pride, right? If you have inappropriate anger as a result of your pride and arrogance, which we all do, because we're all proud and we're all arrogant, then God needs to work on our pride. He needs to work on our humility. So we stop being angry for the sake of our own reputation and the sake of what we feel like people should do for us, and we start being angry for the correct reasons. I'm not going to get into that one tonight. If you want to learn more about that, I did a 3-part series on pride, and it's on our site in this series. The next way that he has to do, and this is one we are going to focus on tonight, is that God, through prayer and following him in a deep relationship, God teaches us how to forgive other people. And that is the practical way that we deal with wrath. He teaches us how to forgive people. Now the question is, how does he do this practically? Okay, how does God practically do this in our lives? I just got 2 points for you guys tonight, and then we'll wrap up. First point is, God is the only one that can actually do this work in our lives, right? He's the only one that can do it. So before we even get to the practicality of how he does it, we need to recognize this. It is only by a relationship with God in which you are able to express your anger with him in an honest, genuine way that God can correct you and help you sort through your anger in a positive way to bring you towards forgiveness. That's a mouthful, but this is the point. Because of that, that means you have to have a genuine relationship with God in order to deal with your anger. You must have a genuine relationship with God in which you have the ability to be honest with him in order to deal with your anger and to be able to forgive those people that have wronged you, okay? What prevents people from doing this? Last week, we used the story of Joseph to understand wrath, and we're still gonna be going through his story this week too. Joseph was a guy who was favored by his dad. His dad treated Joseph like the favorite, and that created wrath in his brothers. And the wrath of his brothers became so great that they actually betrayed Joseph, threw him in a pit, and sold him into slavery. So as you can see, that the brothers' wrath was actually justified. They were angry because their dad was doing something unjust. It wasn't right what their dad was doing. But they allowed that bitterness to sit in so powerfully that what they did was unjust, right? They attacked their brother, who actually wasn't to be faulted. It was the dad's fault. They attacked Joseph, and then they also did something that was inappropriate. They took justice and matters into their own hands and abused their brother as a result. Tonight what we're going to be talking about is, how did Joseph not continue the cycle of violence? Because bitterness produces bitterness. My wrath towards another person is going to make them wrathful towards me, and it's going to perpetuate a cycle. Right? So how did Joseph break the cycle? How did he forgive his brothers? These are the things that he did that enabled him to have a relationship with God in which he was able to practically deal with his wrath. The first thing is that he dealt with his bitterness towards God. This is Genesis 41, verse 51 through 52. So this is after Joseph has been delivered from slavery, he's been delivered from prison, and now he's actually become the leader of Egypt. God's raised him up to be the leader of Egypt. And this is what Joseph says. Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. So what Joseph, the names that Joseph gives his children are very significant, because what he's saying is he's actually thanking God. He's thanking and praising God for helping him to forget the toil of his past and actually become fruitful in his present. This tells me, and it should tell you too, that Joseph has done something that very few of us have done. And that is he has forgiven, and that's kind of an inappropriate word, because forgiven would signify that God has done something wrong, but he has found a way to justify God's seeming inaction in the injustices of his life. Whether we admit it or not, when something bad happens to you, the first person you blame is God, right? Whether you admit it or not. Even people who don't believe in God, when something bad happens to them, blame God, right? That is just the first instinct, right? Whenever a tragedy happens, they say, where's God, right? They get really pissed off at him. I'm like, I thought you didn't believe in him, right? I guess he's nowhere, right? He's a delusion, right? So I don't understand why you're asking that. But you know, whenever something bad happens, our knee-jerk instinct is to blame God. And whether you admit it or not, I know we're in church and we don't like to admit it, whether you admit it or not, there are parts of you that blame God for the injustices of your life. That's just a fact. If you blame God for your past, it's really hard to confide in him in the present. If you blame God for your past, it's really difficult to confide in him in the present. It's hard to have an intimate, personal, honest relationship with God when all the while in your heart, deep down, you blame him for why your life is the way it is. You do. And so do I. How easy would it have been for Joseph to look at God and say, God, how could you let this happen? How could you let this happen? You let my brothers kidnap me? You let them sell me into slavery? And then a lot of other injustices happened to him while he was in Egypt? God, where were you in all that? And maybe he had some theology in his mind where people are like, God is everywhere at once. He never leaves you. He never forsakes you. And Joseph would be like, well, if that's true, then that makes God my abuser. And a lot of people have said things like that. If God is present with you all the time and he is all powerful and he makes nothing happens outside of his will, that means whatever wrong has happened to you, whatever injustice has happened to you, God has allowed. God has allowed. And that makes it very easy to blame God. So how did Joseph not blame God? How did Joseph stay away from that? Okay. Actually, before I give you the way that he did it, I'll just say this. Years ago, there was a shooting in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. 2006, I think. It was an Amish community. A man went into an Amish school filled with little kids. You know, I don't think any of them were over the age of 15. Very, very young. And he lined up a group of 10 Amish girls against a wall, and he executed three of them before taking his own life. Now, when people look at, he actually said why he did it. He actually told people why he did it, because all of his neighbors were like, I don't understand. He was a nice guy. He was a truck driver. He had a wife. He had kids. You know, why would he do something like this? When they dug in his past, this is what they found. They found that during the course of his marriage, his wife had miscarried three times. And he said in wrath, he said, God took three of my girls. I'm going to take three of his. That's why he did it. Right? Now, as evil and wicked and horrible as it was, that man was just expressing a bitterness and a wrath towards God that a lot of us feel too, right? That's what he was doing, and that's what caused him to do that evil, wicked, horrible act. But what did Joseph do so that he didn't go down this path? I'll give you guys just a couple things. Number one, and he basically says them here. Number one, he had to recognize that allowing is not the same as causing. He had to recognize that allowing something to happen is not the same thing as causing it. Okay, there is all the difference in the world between me as a parent. Let's say I have a child that is kind of an idiot. Let's say I have a kid just like me, right? Because I was an idiot. And as a kid, I remember I used to always be fascinated with fire. And I used to always try to touch it because I thought it was just so cool the way it moved. It was kind of pyro, right? And I remember as a kid, my dad has to, I was about to run into a bonfire. And my dad actually grabbed me and he yelled at me. He's like, Peter, don't do that. You know, like, it's stupid, you know? And I was really offended. I was like, how dare you? You know, how dare you allow that to happen? Now, one of the ways that my dad could have disciplined me, though, is let's say I was playing with a candle or something. My dad disciplined me a couple times. But then eventually he's like, you know what? That kid is an idiot. And he just needs to learn that fire is hot for himself. So he might have just allowed me to stick my hand in the flame, right? Now, my dad allowing me to do that, he didn't do that, by the way, but if he allowed me to do that, that would have taught me really quickly, wouldn't it? I would have put my hand in, I would have burned myself, and I'd be like, oh, fire hot, I'm not going to do that anymore, right? It would have been pretty simple. The reason why I kept playing with it is because I never touched fire, and I didn't know what it would do to me, right? If he would allow me to do that, that would probably kept me away from fire for the rest of my life, but he never did. But there's all the difference in the world between my dad allowing me to do that and my dad grabbing my hand and forcing my hand into the fire. Do you guys see the difference? One's child abuse, the other is actually parenting. It's all the difference in the world if God physically abuses you compared to allowing something abusive to happen to you. There is a big, wide difference, and Joseph had to separate the two. He had to separate the two. He had to say, God has allowed this to happen, but God didn't do it to me. God didn't throw him into a pit. God didn't sell him into slavery. God didn't do that. God allowed it to happen, but he didn't actually do it. Okay, and that's a big thing to overcome. Just that right there. Dealing with God and saying, God, help me to see that you are not my abuser. You're not the person who did this to me. Someone else did this to me, right? Or something else happened to me, right? The fallenness of the world or the fallenness of man has hurt me, and that is what I should blame, not you. That's the first thing. The second thing that you have to understand is that God has allowed all things for the goodness and the betterment of you and his own glory. This is something that's really hard for us to grab. And in the moment when Joseph was younger, it would have been really difficult for him to understand. How could a kid understand that somehow being betrayed by his own brothers and thrown into slavery was going to result in the salvation of the entire country, including his family? Which is what ended up happening, right? Because Joseph went into slavery, he ended up being raised up to a position of power that was so high that he was able to save the world when a famine happened, right? If Joseph never went into slavery, that would have never happened. He would have never saved the world, and he would have just starved to death with his family. So because that tragedy happened to him, something good came out of it, right? God had a plan. He had a plan that he was working, and Joseph's suffering was a part of that plan. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't something that just happened that God really wanted to stop, but he couldn't, or he really wanted it to happen because he hated Joseph. That wasn't it. God had a plan, and that plan included suffering for Joseph. This is really, really tough. Okay, I'll tell you guys, this will take a long time for any of us to be able to do this with any of our tragedies. There are a couple tragedies in my life that I've been able to honestly say that I've done this to. I've been able to do what Joseph did. But there's a lot that I haven't yet. I'm still working on them. Okay? But this is what you need to do. You need to believe, not see, because you're not always going to be able to see it. You need to believe by faith that there is a good reason why God allowed that to happen to you. That he didn't let it happen to you because he's a jerk. He let it happen to you because there's something good that's going to come out of it. And the ultimate evidence that we have, that we as Christians should always look back to, is the crucifixion of Jesus. If God the Father could allow his Son to go through that, to be flayed alive, nailed to a cross, mocked, spat upon, and killed in front of people, if God could allow that to happen to himself, to his own Son, and he says, this is for the salvation of all mankind, that gives me confidence and faith that the pain that I go through on a daily basis has a purpose and a plan behind it. Right? That God allows it because there's a purpose in that pain. Every injustice that happens to you has a purpose behind it. It's not random. It's not meaningless. It is purposeful. By faith, you have to trust that. 2 Corinthians 4, I encourage you guys, if you struggle in this area, write this passage down and meditate on it. It's saved me a lot in my life. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. Paul says, this light, momentary affliction is bringing about for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Right? The light affliction that you're going through right now is bringing about a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. I don't know what that glory is. I don't know if even you're going to see it this side of heaven. But he's doing something in your suffering. That's what you have to believe by faith. And Paul goes on and he says, for we do not look at the things which are seen, but the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporary, but the things that are unseen are eternal. You have to, by faith, not look at the things that are seen, but trust in the unseen. And that will vindicate God over time. It'll vindicate God over time. Don't ignore this. Don't pretend because you're a Christian that you don't have bitterness towards God. Deal with it, or it'll deal with you. Next. The next thing that prevents us from having this kind of relationship with God is having shame before God. What I've realized in my life and what I've realized in my time of counseling is that some of the most bitter, wrathful people on the planet have the most hatred towards themselves. I've seen that in my life, seen that in other people's lives. Some of the people that have the worst amount of wrath are the people that have the deepest amount of self-hatred. The reason is because what wrath has become for people like that is wrath has become a coping mechanism for their failures. Where the way that they go through their life and feel like they're an okay person is by blaming and being angry at other people around them. And the second they let go of that wrath is the second they have to reflect on the mistakes and regrets that they have to deal with. They don't want to do that. So they hold on to wrath. If you have shame before God, if you feel like I don't have the right to go before God, I have failed so desperately, you won't go to God to seek forgiveness for other people. You'll try to deal with it on your own. Most of us don't go to God because we have shame towards him. I don't know about you, but I kind of hate being around people that always throw in my face past failures. Right, that just make me feel like junk all the time. I don't like that. A lot of the reason why I don't have a deeper amount of intimacy for God is because sometimes I feel like that's what he's doing to me. When I go to church, I feel condemned for the things that I've done, and I feel like God is throwing those things in my face. And because of that, it's hard for me to go before God and be like, God, be my solution to these issues. If you see God as the problem, it's really difficult to look to him to be the solution. To ask him honestly for help. That self-hatred, that blame and regret that you carry around with you is keeping you from God getting rid of wrath, from God giving you peace in your wrath. You won't go to him because you feel too shame-ridden. This also applies to having shame about the feelings that you have. Okay, this is, I'm sorry, before I go into that, I just want to read Psalm 32 for you guys. Psalm 32, David says this, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all day long. For my day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Timothy Keller commented on that passage, and he says this, God removes our objective guilt. So I can't be brought into punishment. And he removes my subjective shame and self-hatred so we don't remain in inner anguish. The happiest, most blessed people in the world are those who not only know that they deeply need to be forgiven, but also have experienced it. The reason why you're hiding from God, the reason why you don't want to deal with God is because you feel so full of regret and shame about what you've done in your past. But that regret only grows. The only person who could get rid of your regret is the one who could forgive you. And only God could do that. Before you deal with your wrath towards other people, deal with your wrath towards yourself. Deal with your self-hate before God. Go before God, confess your sins, and ask him, God, help me by the eyes of faith to believe that you have forgiven me, that I don't have to labor under this weight of shame anymore because you look at me and you see perfect. I see broken, you see someone who's perfected, right? Someone who's been forgiven, someone who's loved. Help me to see myself through your eyes. God will also, I don't have time to get into this tonight, but God will also help you separate some of the false hatred you have for yourself. A lot of times, actually, I will get into it just later. A lot of times in our life, we have a lot of blame, but we're actually bearing blame that doesn't belong to us. We blame ourselves for things that were done to us and not what we've actually done. I see this all the time, especially when I deal with, when I talk to people who have been molested, raped, left, things like that, where they were physically abused, where they will inwardly blame themselves for what happened to them. They will inwardly blame themselves for what happened to them. As you pray to God, God will help you realize what's your fault and what isn't. Right? He will forgive what's your fault, and he will excuse what isn't. Right? But you got to go to God for that to happen. Now, the next thing I said is that sometimes we can have shame about our feelings in general. Right? We have shame about our feelings in general. We could think, well, as a Christian, I shouldn't feel angry about this. It's wrong for me to feel angry about this. It's wrong for me to feel angry about God, right? It's wrong for me to be bitter towards him. And so because of that, you won't be honest. You'll fake it. You'll pray, but you'll pray false prayers. You'll say, God, like, I'm not angry at you. You know, you're awesome. God is good all the time, and all the time you're good, man. I love you. You know, when deep down you hate him. Deep down you resent him. Deep down you blame him for all your problems. You won't be honest with him. All right, you look at someone else and be like, God, I love that person. They're so great. You know, when in reality, you're like, I hope they die. You know, like that's what's happening in your heart. You're like, I hope that person dies for what they did to me. I hope they suffer for what they did to me. But you're not honest with God. You just fake it in front of him. That comes from having shame over your emotions. If you're going to get over, if you're going to allow God to forgive your wrath, to get over your wrath, to get rid of it, you need to be honest with him. If you have wrath towards somebody, that is a sin, okay? If you're giving in to these negative things of wrath that we've talked about, that is a sin, but it's more of a sin to lie about it. And you know what? We're all sinners. And the only sin that can't be dealt with is the sin that's hidden. The only sin that God can't deal with is the sin that's hidden. If you expose it and you show it to him and you bring it into the light, he can deal with that sin. He can help you forgive. Okay, Hebrews 4, verse 15 through 16 says this. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Did you know that Jesus struggled with wrath? We'll read the specific passage later. Jesus struggled with wrath. He was tempted just as we are, yet without sin. He knows what it's like to see injustice happen to him and want vengeance. Don't you think that Jesus wanted vengeance when people were killing him? He was human. Of course he did. Don't you think that Jesus wanted vengeance when his best friend betrayed him? Don't you think he wanted vengeance when his own mother didn't believe in his ministry? When his brothers openly mocked him? When people repetitively tried to kill him? Don't you think he wanted vengeance in those moments? Of course he did. But he didn't give in to that wrath. And we'll see later how he did it. But Jesus understands how you feel. You're not talking to a God who doesn't get it. Okay? So the writer of Hebrews says this next. Let us therefore, so because of that, come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. When you're in wrath, you need help. You need help. You don't need greater focus. You don't need greater willpower to get over it and to stop. You need help to be delivered. But if you don't come before his throne to receive that help in your time of need, you're just going to stew in your wrath. By the way, that word boldly is a very interesting one in the original language. It literally means to say anything. I don't know if you guys have a relationship in your life where you feel so comfortable with that person that you feel like you could say anything and they're not going to judge you. Right? They're going to listen to you and they're going to be there for you. There are some relationships where you're like, I probably shouldn't say that in front of that person. But there are some people that hopefully you have in your life that you're like, I could say anything. God is that relationship. You could say anything in front of God because he already knows. In Psalm 139, the passage that we're going to be studying for summer camp, he says, "Behold, before there is a word on my tongue, you know it altogether." Dude, God knows what's in your heart. So when you say these things to him, you're not shocking him. You're not surprising him. You're saying what he already knows. I'll read you just a little section of a psalm that I love, that I read a lot. It's Psalm 58, verse 6 through 11. The writer of this psalm says this about his enemies. He says, "Break their teeth in their mouth, O God. Break the fangs of the young lions. Let them flow away as waters which run continually. When he bends his bow, let his arrows be cut to pieces. Let them be like a snail which melts away as it goes, like a stillborn child of a woman, that they may not see the sun." This one's crazy. He says, "As in the living and burning wrath, the righteous shall rejoice when they see the vengeance of God. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked, so that men will say, surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely he is God who judges in the earth." Do you feel confident enough in your relationship with God to pray that? To like look at the people that you hate and be really brutally honest and say, "God, I want to wash my feet in that dude's blood." You know, like that's a hardcore thing to say before God, but this dude said it, right? "God, I really hope that he gets smacked so hard in the face he loses all of his teeth. Dude, God, I hope that he just like melts like a snail, dude. I hope he just gets jacked up and burned over fire." You know, that's the kind of stuff that he prayed to God. Now you're like, "Peter, you can't say that to God." Really? If you feel it, he already knows. Is it wrong to feel this way? Yep. But this guy realizes it's wrong, and he's giving it to who? To God. He's talking to God about it. Wrath does not go away by stewing on it. So many people tell us that the answer to our anger is by taking it out in nonviolent ways. So meaning sitting alone at home and thinking about what happened, as opposed to actually doing something about it. Or maybe, you know, going to the shooting range and blowing up a bunch of coconuts and being like, "Yeah," you know, like feeling good about that. I used to play violent video games. I was like, "Yeah," I'd play Call of Duty, I'd knife a couple people, be like, "Yeah," you know, anger, you know, wrath is great, you know. That's how I dealt with my anger. But you know, I didn't really deal with it. Made me feel good in the moment, but that wrath was still there and it would come back and it would grow stronger the more I fed it. You can't get rid of your anger by feeding it. You could only get rid of your anger by giving it to God. By the way, this process of getting rid of wrath is a long one. It's a long process. It'll take you, maybe even, depending on how great the injustice is that was done to you, it might take you years to forgive. It might. Don't grow weary and be honest with God. Next, I'll say this one very quickly because we're running out of time. Next reason why you won't do it is because you're enjoying wrath too much and you don't want to forgive that person. Wrath can feel good in the moment. Sometimes we look at the way we feel about someone and we're like, "I don't want to forgive that guy. I want to hate them forever for what they did to me." And that will prevent you, because obviously if you don't want to forgive, you're not going to do it. If you're here, by the way, if you're in this place where you honestly can reflect and be like, "You know, I don't want to forgive that person. I hate them." Okay, I'm not going to tell you, "Hey, just try harder to want to forgive them," because it's not going to work. Go before God and be honest with him. Say, "God, I don't want to forgive this person, but I know that that's wrong. Can you change me? I confess that to you. I confess that this is wrong the way I feel. Help me to want to forgive them, that I could start this process of forgiveness." The other reason why we won't want to forgive is because of excusing. We mistake excusing with forgiveness. I talked about this last week, but I'll reiterate it for you guys. There is a vast difference between forgiving someone and excusing them. Excusing someone means justifying them. It means looking at them and saying, "Hey, what you did actually wasn't wrong. It wasn't wrong. There's nothing to forgive. There's nothing that I need to forgive. There's no wrong to overlook because what you did was not wrong." That's excusing. Forgiving is looking at someone and saying, "What you did was really wrong, but I forgive you." Right? Forgiveness triumphs over wrath. That's what it says in the Bible. Right? So it's not that there isn't a wrong, it's that that injustice needs to be covered by something. Because we mistake forgiving for excusing, though, we don't want to forgive as Christians. Because then we're like, "Well, then that person's getting away with it." No, they're not. That passage that I read in Psalm 58, he ends it by saying that surely there is a reward for the righteous, and surely he is God who judges in the earth. What he's saying is the reason why I can let go of my wrath is because I know that what that person did was wrong, and that there is a God who judges what's wrong. And I believe that. I believe that, I accept that, and I am allowing God to judge in my place. What does that do for us? Psalm 37, verse 8. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Don't fret, it only causes harm. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the earth. Why should you forsake wrath? Why is God telling you to get out of your wrath right now? Because it's only hurting you. It's only hurting you. It might be hurting other people around you too, by the way. But it is specifically hurting you. It's keeping you from God. It's keeping you from peace. And it's ruining your life. God is calling you out of sin, all sin, not just this one, because he loves you too much to leave you in it. Not because he has a bent against it. It's not because he's a killjoy. God calls us out of sin because he loves us too much to allow us to stay in it. He knows what it does to us. He says, yeah, it's short-term gain, man. It'll feel good in the moment to give into wrath, but you're going to suffer. You're going to hurt yourself. Cease from wrath. It only causes harm. Why? Those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the earth. Evildoers are going to be cut off, right? God will judge them. I need to trust that. So I need to pray constantly. God, give me the faith to trust that you're going to judge this person in my place, that I don't have to have wrath against this person to even the score, that I don't have to get right with them, but I have to trust you. Okay? Leads me to the next and final point. Once we get over our obstacles to going towards God, what do we need to do now? We need to go to God consistently, all the time, praying to him every day, as long as it takes, asking for the power to forgive. Don't think because you did it once, it's over. Don't think because you looked someone in the eye and said, hey, I forgive you, that it's over. That wrath is probably still in you. Consistently, as often as you need to, pray and ask God for the power to forgive and the faith to trust his judgment. This is Psalm 50, verse 19 through 20. Joseph has now reconciled with his brothers. They've come to Egypt. They have a relationship, and they're afraid. They're afraid because they know, man, if we get what's coming to us, Joseph will wipe us out. And Joseph says to them, he says, don't be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. Look at how Joseph has come full circle. He has completely justified God. Look what he says. You meant it for evil. Man, he's not excusing anything they did. He's like, you did something wicked against me. But God was doing something beautiful, even in your wickedness. And look what he also says. Am I in the place of God? Is what you did wrong? Yep, but I'm not the right one to judge you. It's wrong, but I'm not the correct person to judge you. It's just going to hurt me if I try to judge you. God will judge you. I'm not in the place of God. All right, so let's talk about, just really quickly, let's go over a couple things practically that's going to happen in our hearts that's going to allow us to do what Joseph did. So practically, where is God? What is God going to do to you to get you to where Joseph is? Right? What's going to happen over time? First, he will help us separate and accept excuses and understand the difference between them and explanations. Okay, James 1, verse 19 through 20 says this, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. So what James is saying is that what your wrath will not allow you to do is to hear someone out. Your wrath won't want to do that because your wrath won't care. When someone will do something offensive to you and they're like, hey, let me explain, you'll be like, I don't want to hear it. I don't care. I've already made up my mind about what you did. I don't really care about your excuses. I don't want to hear it. Right? You won't listen to them. James says, be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Why? Because they might have legitimate excuses, but they might not. This brings me to the second point that I brought up. There's a difference between excusing and explaining. A lot of times we mix the two definitions, though, but they're not the same thing. An explanation just shows why someone did something. An excuse shows that not only why they did it, but the fact that the reason of why they did it makes what they did okay. Okay? There's an explanation for why Joseph's brothers did this to him. Correct? There's a good explanation. It's a very good one. They were overlooked by their dad. They were unloved by their father. They were abused by Joseph, right? Because Joseph would taunt them. verbally. He wouldn't have physically abused him, but he would verbally taunt them. So there's a lot of good reasons of why they did what they did to him. But Joseph never says, hey, I know that you guys did this wrong thing to me, but don't worry about it. I was kind of a jerk back then too. He doesn't say that. A lot of Christians would say something like that, but Joseph doesn't say that. He's like, yeah, it's a good explanation for why you did it, but it doesn't excuse anything you did. It doesn't justify it. It doesn't make it right. It makes it, it's still wrong, right? It's still wrong. Whenever someone gives you an explanation, understand the difference between an explanation and an excuse. If I go and I talk to someone who, like, you know, cut me off in traffic or, you know, abused me or yelled at me, and they're like, oh, I'm so sorry, man. You know, when I was a kid, my dad used to abuse me. Now, that's an explanation for why that guy's a jerk, but it doesn't excuse what he's doing. It's not an excuse. You need to understand that there's a difference between excuses and explanations. Maybe some of what they're saying is good excuses, though. What do you do with that? Understand that we tend to see things too simplistically. We think it's all or nothing. We think either all of what they did was forgiven or all of what they did is excused. But we don't think that there's stuff in the middle. Life is almost never that simple. There will always be a mixture. Okay, maybe some of what they did is excusable. But what about the bit that's left over? What if 50% of what they did to you was excusable? You still have to forgive 50%. Does that make sense? You need to understand their excuses and see if they're valid. Maybe they have some valid ones. Maybe, you know, maybe you're angry at, you know, I'm going to use an example for, you know, when we were a kid. You know, as a kid, I used to be angry and upset that my dad didn't used to show affection and love towards me in the way that I wanted. I was angry and upset about that. I didn't feel loved by my dad because he didn't know how to express it in the right way. Looking back as an adult, I've excused so much of what he did because I realized it's not his fault. You know, it really wasn't. My dad was showing me love. He just didn't know how to show it in the way I would receive it, right? So I have to excuse almost all of that. But there's still a little portion of it where I'm like, well, you still could have worked on it a little bit, and I need to forgive that, right? And if I were to talk to my dad about it, he'd be like, yeah, you're right. You know, he wouldn't hide from that truth. He'd be like, yeah, you're right, but I love you. You know, I'd be like, I know that now. But that was something that God had to do in me. I had to be able to excuse the parts of it that could be excused and forgive the rest. It's never all or nothing. It's almost never all or nothing. For Joseph, it was. For Joseph, he says, none of it's excused. None of it's excused. I have to forgive all of it. Right? And sometimes that will happen. And sometimes you will excuse all of it. But for the most part, you're going to excuse some and forgive the rest. That's also true for you, by the way. It's also true for you. If you bear self-hatred, almost never is it all your fault. Almost never. Usually there are excuses that maybe you're not even willing to accept for what you did. Okay? But it doesn't mean that what you did is completely excusable. It just means that there might be some excuses for it. And you need to allow God to speak that into your life. Okay? When we excuse instead of forgive. So what happens if we try to do the good Christian thing and someone comes and apologizes to us and gives us a lot of explanations for what they did, but no actual excuses justifying them. And we're like, oh, okay, it's Christian for me to just forgive them. And you just excuse everything they did. You think you're forgiving them, but what you actually say verbally is like, well, yeah, I know they did this to me, but they had a lot of good reasons for it, so it's okay. Right? That's not forgiving. Forgiving is saying, yeah, they have a lot of good explanations for it, but what they did was seriously jacked up. And I need to pray and ask God to help me forgive what they did. Right? That's forgiveness. A lot of times we just excuse. What happens to us when we excuse instead of forgive? First of all, it leads to repression. Lots of repression. Because as you're trying to excuse their sin against you, you know in your heart that what they did was seriously jacked up, and you're still going to have vengeance against them. You're still going to have wrath in your heart, whether you admit it or not. If you're a good Christian, you'll never admit it. You'll just let that bitterness sit under the surface for the rest of your life. Right, but that's not going to help you out. The second thing it leads to is bitterness that goes along with repression. Also, I mentioned last week about repression, about a lot of times when we repress anger, it expresses itself towards people who aren't guilty. So when I refuse to admit my anger towards one person, I end up expressing that anger towards everybody in my life and projecting that person on them. Right, so if I'm not, by the way, I'm using this as an example, I'm not. But if I was seriously pissed off at my dad, I might project him onto the people around me that remind me of him and express my anger at them. Right? So I might project them on God. I might think of God like my dad and be pissed off at God. Or I might project him on my boss, or I might project him on my friends, right, and get angry at them and take it out on them, right? That's a result of repression. You're not handling the anger you have towards the specific individual, so you're expressing in unhealthy ways towards the people around you, okay? I already mentioned bitterness. Next is naive acceptance of someone, which will always lead to enabling them. Meaning this, there's a small group of people that really can excuse terrible behavior without forgiving it. That is not a good character quality. That is not a good character quality. Because what these people will do is they will enable violent, wicked, horrible behavior by excusing it and allowing it to continue. They will never call someone to be accountable for their actions. You see this most of the time happen with parents. So I'll use that as an example. But this can happen with anybody, right? So a parent, you're in Walmart, and there's a kid having a temper tantrum, being a little jerk, you know, and he's crying and whining and dragging stuff off the counter and stuff like that. And you look at the parent, you're kind of like, are you gonna do something? And they're like, oh, he's just in one of his moods, you know? What are they doing? They're excusing him, right? They're not holding him accountable for it. They're not like, hey, you're not supposed to act like this. I need to discipline you. They're like, oh, you know, we all have our days, you know, like we all have, yeah, I was there last week. No, you weren't. Okay, that's inappropriate behavior, and you need to express it as such, right? But because you won't do it, you're allowing that kid to continue in his bad behavior, and he's going to grow up to be a selfish jerk, right? That's what you've done to them. Now, this happens in adult relationships all the time, where wives or husbands will enable their spouse in bad, destructive, or addictive behavior, and they'll call it love, right? They'll excuse them. They'll even defend their bad behavior in front of other people. But that's not love. That's not forgiveness. That's excusing, right? We could be guilty of that. Next, it could actually lead to us taking the blame all on ourselves. A lot of times people do this. A lot of times we do this without even recognizing it. When you excuse somebody that shouldn't be excused, in your heart, like I said, you know that the scales are imbalanced. So what happens to that unbalanced scale? Well, you either are going to even it out through bitterness and repression, or you're going to even it out by taking the blame on yourself. That's the worst thing that can happen. That's the worst thing that can happen to somebody. Where you know that what someone did was wrong, and you find yourself confessing it as your sin. I hear people do this. Usually it's wives, but I hear them do it all the time. Where their husband will cheat on them and they'll say something like, oh, well, you know, if only I should have been more loving to him or something like that. It's kind of my fault. I'm like, are you serious? Are you serious? I know he probably said that to you, but it doesn't make it a fact. Right? Yeah, he hit me, but, you know, I was antagonizing him. That might be true, but it doesn't excuse him hitting you. Right? When you take the blame, when you excuse somebody, it forces you to take the blame and become a victim. That would be very damaging to your identity, and it would be very damaging to your walk with God as well. I can't spend any more time on that. The next thing that God will do with us is he will help us depersonalize the offense. Notice what he says, God is your judge. It's hard for us to do this because we'll be like, God's not your judge. You hurt me. You need to deal with me. I don't care about you and God. I care about me. Right? That's pride. Talking when you say that. You need to understand that their sin is ultimately before God and therefore must ultimately be judged by God. You are not a good, qualified source of wrath and justice towards other people. Only God is. I told you that I would read this passage later, and here it is. 1 Peter 2, verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ suffered for us, leaving us an example, that you should follow his footsteps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he committed himself to him who judges righteously. How did Jesus not seek vengeance when people were hurting him? It says it right at the end. He committed himself to him who judges righteously. He trusted his Father to even the scales. He says, Father, you're going to take care of these people. The cross, by the way, is the ultimate reason for us as Christians to believe that God is going to handle sin. The cross should show us that God doesn't take sin lightly. It shows us that he takes it so seriously that he needed to die for our sins. We as Christians need to understand that there is a final judgment. There is a final judgment. God will even all the scales. He will make all things right. And we need to believe in that and trust in that, even if it doesn't happen in this life. Sometimes God's justice will start impacting people in this life. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes you really do have to wait till the next. But you have to believe and trust, just like Jesus did, that God will even the scales. I don't have to. And that will set you free. I don't have time to go into this. I would like to go into this. This is going to sound like a cop-out. I'm sorry. If you are in a situation where you have had someone do something really offensive and wrong to you, understand that there is also a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. Forgiveness is commanded by God. Reconciliation is not. Forgiveness is saying to God, I trust you to judge this person. I don't want to have the wrath anymore. I want you to judge them. And when you do that, that opens you up to reconciliation, but it doesn't always result in reconciliation. Reconciliation is repairing a relationship. It's a very different thing. Forgiveness is commanded, reconciliation is not, because forgiveness is ultimately between you and God. The other person might have nothing to do with your forgiveness of them. Joseph forgave his brothers before he even saw them, right? He didn't even see them yet, and he forgave them. Reconciliation happened later, okay? I wish I could get into this, but there's just too much gray area in reconciliation. This is what I'll say. I'll just say a couple things. Number one, reconciliation is going to be hinged on how severe the sin was against you and where that person is at. Okay? If the sin that you're forgiving is something like sexual or physical abuse, do not reconcile with that person if they are not repentant and have shown fruit of repentance. And even if you do reconcile with someone like that, set up healthy boundaries and keep your distance. Allow them to demonstrate their repentance to you. And know that you probably never will have the same exact relationship with them that you once did. Okay? There is an example in the Bible of two people that the sin was so severe that they never reconciled and it was actually okay by God. God actually commanded it. Okay? Sarah and Hagar in the Old Testament. Hagar was Abraham's handmaid. Sarah was his wife. At one point, Sarah convinced Abraham, and he agreed with it, so he was an idiot. But anyway, he agreed to have sex with Sarah's handmaid to try to have a kid with her. They ended up having a kid. Now, could you ladies imagine living in the same household with someone that your husband committed adultery with you on? Right? That's hardcore, right? And you see the kid running around. That's intense. At some point, God tells Hagar to leave. He's like, look, this is toxic. Right, you leave. He didn't say, hey, forgiveness needs to happen, guys. You all need to get along. God's like, no, this is so toxic. You got to go. Right? They did forgive one another, but God realized that that relationship could not be what it was. It just couldn't. There had to be separation. There had to be boundaries drawn up. Okay? So if you're in a situation like this, what I would encourage you to do, go to a counselor, go to a mentor, someone like that, and talk to them about it. Right? Because there's a lot of gray area. If the offense was small, though, if it was a tiny offense, like someone lied to you or something like that, or lost their temper at you, okay, reconciliation's much easier and it can happen much faster. But it's always useful if there is repentance, meaning the other person is sad about what they did. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up by reading a quote from C.S. Lewis and then sharing a little bit more of that story from the Pennsylvania shooting. C.S. Lewis in The Weight of Glory said this: to be a Christian means to forgive the inexcusable because God has forgiven the inexcusable in you. This is hard. It is perhaps not so hard to forgive a single great injury, but to forgive the incessant provocations of daily life, to keep on forgiving the bossy mother-in-law, the bullying husband, the nagging wife, the selfish daughter, the deceitful son. How can we do it? Only, I think, by remembering where we stand. By meaning our words when we say in our prayers each night, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. We are offered forgiveness on no other terms. To refuse it is to refuse God's mercy for ourselves. There is no hint of exceptions, and God means what he says. Okay? This is what I want you guys to take away from this. Forgiveness is important, and is beautiful. It will set you free from your wrath, but it has to be done before you and God. Settle things with God first, then settle things with the other person. And know that sometimes reconciliation just isn't in the cards. This is what I'm going to wrap up with. The Pennsylvania shooting that I mentioned earlier, this is a radical part of the story that most news outlets didn't talk about, but it happened and it's amazing. After the shooting, at the funeral for the man who did it, the wife was there, and she was at the funeral. And the whole Amish community, including the parents who had lost children, came to that funeral, went to the wife and said publicly, "We forgive your husband for what he did." And they gave her flowers and they financially supported her for the rest of the time while she got back up on her feet. That's an amazing, incredible thing for people to do. And we can look at that and be like, how did these people do that? How do they forgive something that atrocious? And they didn't do it in their own strength. They did it in the power of God. That's what that story does. It glorifies God, that God did that. That's something human beings can't do. All right, but God can do that in you. If he can do it in them, he can do it in me, and that means he can do it in you as well. If you want to be set free from wrath, you know where to go. All right, let's pray. Father, I thank you so much for your word, and I pray that we take these words to heart. God, that we would look at the wrath that we struggle with in our daily lives, and that we would learn to give those to you in honesty. We would know and remember that every single one of us, none of us are free from this. None of us have arrived to the place where we don't have wrath anymore. God, so let us be honest with each other and with you. God, to work through these things and to gain wisdom in the relationships that we're struggling. Lord, please help us. Please forgive us for the wrath that we have. And help us to receive that forgiveness. And in your name, amen.